In this segment, we will discuss more modern approaches to clinical decision support. In this segment, the focus will be on two forms that are somewhat related, reminders and alerts. What distinguishes these modern approaches is that they take advantage of the context of the electronic health record. Reminders remind clinicians to perform various actions, whereas alerts alert them in critical situations. We will talk about computerized physician order entry, CPOE, in another unit. When we talk about clinical decision support, it is helpful to think of the different elements of it. The taxonomy of clinical decision support was developed by Adam Wright and has four components. The first element of the taxonomy is triggers, which are events that cause rules to be invoked, such as an order being entered, a lab result being stored in the system, or a patient being admitted to the hospital. The second element is input data, which are data elements that are used by the rules, such as the result of a lab that was just ordered or entered, any other kind of observation, prescription of a drug, the establishment of a diagnosis, or a patient's age. Third are interventions, which are possible actions that the clinical decision support system can take. These have dimensions, so they may be urgent things that need to be done right away or non-urgent. We may wish to notify the user synchronously, in a dialog box in the system, or more asynchronously, perhaps through an email. Types of interventions include notifying the user, entering the result into a log, or trying to obtain more dates from a user. The final element of the taxonomy is the specific choices that we offer to the user. We may offer the user a choice of writing an order, allowing the user to defer action until later, letting the user override the advice of the system, or allowing the user to cancel or edit a particular order. Wright has also written about the evolution of clinical decision support systems. He identifies four phases that they have gone through. The first phase was standalone systems, including those that are discussed in other parts of Component 11, Unit 3. The second phase was integrated systems, where the decision support was integrated into electronic health records. The development of standards-based systems, such as the Arden syntax, noted by Wright that we will discuss later, comprised the third phase. Finally, the fourth and latest phase is the service model, based on service-oriented architecture, including the system that was developed in the work of Wright's dissertation called SANS. He has also looked at evaluating commercial decision support systems to see how much of the desired features they have. He has published an evaluation of 9 leading systems, which showed that there is a broad diversity of desired features in different systems. Computer-based reminders are not a new idea, and as with diagnostic decision support, there is some older literature that represents some classic work in the field. One of the early workers in this area was Clem MacDonald. He wrote a paper in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1976 talking about the non-perfectibility of man, which was the term he used as opposed to humans. He found that computer-based reminders showed some reduction in error in the process of delivering medical care. Octo Barnett, also an early worker in the field, showed that reminders for untreated streptococcal pharyngitis, also known as strep throat, led to increased use of treatment. Of course, the reason for this reminder was due to the fact that when untreated, strep throat can progress in a very small number of cases to acute rheumatic fever. Clem MacDonald did another study in 1984, showing that a paper printout of reminders to order routine preventive care did result in increased utilization. There were some other interesting findings from these studies. One was that when you remove the prompting, the behavior returned to baseline. That is, when you took away the reminders, the clinician would return to their previous lower level of ordering the right test or treatment. Thus, it was deemed that these effects were not educational. They merely reminded busy physicians to do things that they ought to be doing. Here you see a figure from Dr. Barnett's paper where the treatment of streptococcal pharyngitis, when augmented with a reminder to the clinician, resulted in the number of patients without treatment changing from 10% to close to zero. When the reminders were taken out of the system, the percent of people not treated went back up. In more recent times, reminders have also been shown to be beneficial. David Bates showed that they led to reduced ordering of redundant laboratory tests, or laboratory tests that were really not necessary. When the clinician was reminded of this, the ordering of these tests was reduced. There was a systematic review of reminders in medication management from 2003 that summarized all the literature up to that point. Reminders were found to lead to a number of beneficial activities, such as appropriate changes in classes of medications prescribed, increasing generic prescribing, improving activities related to medication management, and enhancing patient adherence to medication regimen. It was also found that reminders that were prospective and provided in real time were more effective than providing feedback in a retrospective manner after the fact. In other words, putting the reminder up on the screen is more effective than telling the physician that he or she should have prescribed a drug differently. There is some other research of note on reminders. One study reported that reminders were found to increase the delivery of recommended care in patients with diabetes and coronary artery disease. Another study on reminders had a profound impact on the serious condition of deep venous thrombosis, DVT, prophylaxis. A reminder for DVT prophylaxis was found to reduce the actual rate of either DVT or pulmonary embolism by 41%. Another study looked at factors associated with completion of reminders. What factors were more likely to lead physicians to actually act on reminders? It was found that incorporating clinical support staff in the reminder process and feedback to physicians was associated with completion of reminders. However, there were no other characteristics of the clinicians, such as age, gender, or clinical experience, that impacted the completion of these reminders. Alerts are usually used to detect and report adverse events. They are often used in the context of CPOE, and they have been successfully used in many clinical situations, such as nosocomial infections or infections that develop in the hospital, adverse drug events, preventing injurious falls, and emerging diseases or related issues like bioterrorism. What is the rationale of providing alerts to clinicians? Bates did an analysis of critical lab results in the 1990s and found that an appropriate response, usually a quicker response, might prevent 4.1% of adverse events, and another 5.5% might be prevented just by improved communication of the results. A study by Tate found that only 50% of life-threatening lab results were reported appropriately. This was in 1990. And we have hopefully improved since then. However, there are still many instances where serious lab results are not reported. Cooperman, in 1998, found that in critical lab results, 27% of patients did not receive treatment for what was diagnosed by those lab results, usually an infection, within 5 hours. And Poon, asking physicians about reporting test results, found that there was dissatisfaction with the ways that they were currently reported. Physicians expressed a desire for help with tracking the results through completions, sending letters to patients, and improving overall workflow efficiency. Alerts are usually generated by clinical event monitors. These are systems that detect events and suggest actions based on those events. Clinical event monitors allow integration of decision support within the electronic health record. There are three components of clinical event monitors. There is the event, which is something that triggers a rule to be applied. For example, when a hemoglobin test is being performed, there is a condition that tests whether some sort of action should be performed, such as, is the hemoglobin value low enough so that the patient is critically anemic? Then, if there is an action that needs to be taken, the clinician is usually informed through a message. Since these are automated systems, it is important that the data be of high quality. It needs to be recent data, and it must be valid. For example, sometimes a blood specimen will be hemolyzed. that is the red blood cells, will have been broken open in the process of drawing the blood, and that will elevate the potassium level. This can generate an alert, and the clinician must be able to find out quickly whether or not this specimen was found to be hemolyzed by the laboratory, or if the patient actually has a high potassium level. This is a diagram showing the clinical alerting system at Brigham and Women's Hospital. There's an event monitor that knows about the patients and the rules. New data comes in that is evaluated by the event monitor. If some form of alert is required, this activates a notification program that activates the paging computer, informing the physician, who has to log on to the computer and take action. In the description of the Brigham and Women's Event Monitor, Cooperman also gave examples of some of the alerting criteria and how frequently they were activated. The most common rule, making up almost 20% of alert rules, was when the hematocrit, the proportion of blood volume that is occupied by red blood cells, fell by 10% or more since the last result, and the current percent is now less than 26. Another rule related to hematocrit is that the value has fallen 6% or more since the previous result and has fallen faster than 0.4% per hour since the last result and is now less than 26%, and the patient is not on the cardiac surgery service. As you can see, these rules get pretty complicated. This one is basically a patient who is bleeding in a non-cardiac surgery situation. Another common rule relates to serum glucose, the value being greater than or equal to 400 milligrams per deciliter. In addition, another common rule relates to serum potassium, if greater than or equal to 6.0 milliequivalent deciliter. Sometimes the physician does not respond to an alert, so at Brigham and Women's Hospital, they have a series of additional steps to ensure that an important alert is communicated to the physician. If a physician is paged and does not respond in 15 minutes, the border of the computer screen on the patient's floor turns red, which is then noted by the nurse, who then tries to contact the physician or take other action. If the alert is not acknowledged within 30 minutes, then a workstation in a telecommunication suite starts beeping to alert the phone operator to contact the floor of the physician. So how well did the alerting system function? Cooperman compared this system to situations where there was no automatic notification and noted that the alerting intervention resulted in a 38% median time interval until appropriate treatment was ordered, 1.0 versus 1.6 hours. There was a shorter time until the alerting condition was resolved, 8.4 versus 8.9 hours, although at least in this study, there was no difference in actual adverse events. A more recent study showed that alerts for multidrug-resistant bacteria in a hospital in France were found to increase the implementation of isolation precautions more than when the alerts were not used. There are a number of issues concerning alerts. One is, how are they best delivered to the clinician? Do they set off a pager? Does someone make a phone call? And do we send an email? This really gets to one of the big problems with alerts, which is volume control, although it is now more frequently called alert fatigue. Physicians complain of alert fatigue because they are alerted so many times in the electronic health record systems that they use. We clearly want to communicate the most important alerts, but we do not want to overload the clinicians, particularly with alerts that do not require immediate action. There are also a number of medical legal issues, such as what do we do about clinicians who do not respond to alert? What do we do when alerts are not appropriately generated by the system and something is missed when we are depending on them? Another issue with alerts is how do we detect the alerting condition? Obviously, it is easier to do with coded or numeric data, but it is more challenging when we are trying to rely on information in textual reports to alert us. And then, how do we standardize alerts across different systems? That brings us to ARDEN syntax, mentioned earlier, which we will talk about in the next slide. ARDEN syntax has been around for over a decade now. It is a procedural language that allows delivery of what are called medical logic modules, or MLMs. These MLMs then allow sharing of decision support roles across different systems if decision support using Arden syntax is implemented by that system. Arden syntax specifies an event, a condition, and an action. It is also now a standard, ASTM E1460, and has also been recently converted to XML, or Extensible Markup Language. This slide shows an example of Arden syntax. It looks like computer code for those of you familiar with computer code. The situation here is a penicillin order, which is the event. The prescriber has ordered a drug from the penicillin class, so it might be amoxicillin or methicillin. When that happens, the event then causes the system to look at this rule. It searches patient allergies to see if there are any penicillin-related allergies, because, as most clinicians know, an allergy to one penicillin means that there is an allergy to all of them. The condition the rule looks for is whether there is a penicillin allergy. When that condition is confirmed, an action is taken and the message is sent that the patient's allergy to penicillin has been documented.